Okay, and we are live. So Lisa, I will turn it over to you to introduce our topic and guest speaker.
Okay, great. So this is our second call since we have started inviting guest speakers to
conference muted.
Sorry,
can you
should
hear
get
me
now, Lisa? Yes, I
okay.
Everyone's muted, but you are not. There you go.
So as I was saying, this is our second call since we have begun inviting weekly guest speakers to join our call and talk about issues, both legislative and kind of practical, that are important for us as we move forward with our resistance work. And as you all know, I'm sure a single person on this call who doesn't realize that later this week there will be a vote to repeal the Affordable Care Act or portions of the Affordable Care Act. And I have been incredibly impressed with how well I don't even have words to describe, like, how amazed I am when I see people's posts in on our Facebook page or in the district Facebook groups talking about the phone calls that they've made to their members of Congress and what they said to them about ACA repeal and also the impacts to Medicaid. People have become so well-informed about this issue and also such practiced storytellers, telling their own stories and the stories about their family members and their friends and their neighbors who are going to be impacted by the changes that the Republican Congress and President Trump would like to see happen to our system. But there's always more. And so with our resources this week, we tried to put together not only a script, but also additional information that you can use to find out exactly what ACA repeal could look like in your congressional district, to arm you with more and better information as you call your members. And so to kind of just really put a, you know, an exclamation point on the end of that, today we've invited Melissa McChesney, who is the healthcare outreach coordinator at the Center for Public Policy Priorities here in Austin. And she's my former colleague. I am a huge fan of her work, and I feel very lucky that in my day job, I still have the opportunity to work with her, even though we no longer work at the same organization. And she graciously agreed to talk with us tonight about some of the really specific ways that this bill will impact Texans. So before we get to that, I just want to say a couple things about some events that are happening this week. One of our sister organizations based in Waco, the Centex Action Network, last week came up with a great idea to hold ACA repeal vigils this week. And we sort of shared out this information a little bit, and the response was amazing. And there are now, I think, close to a dozen vigils planned for tomorrow evening throughout Texas. If you, and there are some here in the Austin area. So if you would go to our website, indivisibleaustin.com, and go to our weekly actions page, we've been updating that, the actions for the week link. We've been updating that with vigils both in person and online, because Indivisible DFW has organized an online action. And really the idea here is for us to bring attention to the lives that will be impacted by the repeal of the Affordable Care Act. There's no doubt that people's health will be harmed. And I think we have to anticipate that there are people who will lose their lives because of the decisions that our lawmakers are taking to really end access, not just access to healthcare, but availability of healthcare to 24 million Americans over the next 10 years. So a vigil seemed like a sadly appropriate way to commemorate what we see happening at the federal level. There are a number of other things happening this week, so I don't want to take up too much time kind of going through a calendar, but I will call your attention to our calendar also on the IndivisibleAustin.com page under the Resources tab. Each week we're adding more and more community events to the calendar, and as we know about them, action days also at the Capitol, which brings me to something new that just really is kind of getting off the ground this week. There is a coalition of organizations based here in Austin, but which are either chapters of national organizations like the ACLU and Planned Parenthood and NARAL, for example, as well as local organizations working on various policy issues at the Capitol. And these organizations are coming together to help support each other through the last few weeks of the legislative session. There are many hearings scheduled every day for bills at the legislature, and many of you have probably seen more than one Facebook post inviting people to come to the legislature and testify or sign in to oppose or be in favor of a bill. This coalition has gotten organized in order to try to coordinate that a little bit so that people who are headed to the Capitol for a particular bill or hearing that they're interested in know what else is happening at the Capitol that day, and if they have the ability to go sign in for or against a bill while they're there to take the time to do that. So if things happening at the legislature are top of mind for you, I encourage you to follow our Texas Legislature Indivisible group on Twitter. Our sort of chief organizer for the Texas Ledge group, Matt, is very active on Twitter, live tweeting hearings, and he's pretty much at the Capitol every day. And so it's kind of a weird Twitter handle, but if you just look up Indivisible TX Ledge on Twitter, you'll find us. And, you know, there's not even 2 months left, really, in the legislative session for the meat of the action. And so things are starting to move very, very quickly. So start following Indivisible TX Ledge, find out what's going on there. And if you are so moved and find yourself at the Capitol during the week, it would be wonderful to start to get connected with folks from the coalition to be able to go register for or against those bills. If you're interested in more about that, send us a note to ask@indivisibleaustin.com, and we can help get you set up on the notification list for those daily actions at the Capitol. Okay, so without much further ado, I am pleased to introduce Melissa, who she has an outstanding background in healthcare in Texas. So she is extremely knowledgeable about not just what's happening at the federal level, with the Affordable Care Act, but also what the impacts are in the state with regard to our Medicaid program, which will also be impacted by this legislation. So I turn it over to you, Melissa. Thank you for joining us.
Great. Thank you, Lisa. And Lisa, what time would you, just to sort of make sure that I keep it at the right length, when would you like to sort of get to the Q&A section?
So we usually do the talking part up until about 8:30.
Okay.
We have about 20 minutes.
Mm-hmm. Perfect. That's perfect. Okay, so, excuse me. So I'm just super glad to be on the call today. As Lisa mentioned, I work for the Center for Public Policy Priorities, but I'm actually now technically based in Houston, but I'm their first sort of remote worker. So it's so great to have a connection back to the Indivisible Group there in Austin. I've been working with the Indivisible Group here in Houston some as well, so great to speak with everyone tonight. So I have a feeling that on the call there are some, as Lisa mentioned, that have some pretty good knowledge and understanding of exactly what we're looking at when we're looking at the House's repeal bill, but there may be others on the call who are sort of have more to learn. So I want to take us through the major components of the bill. I will say there's a lot, and there's a lot of little bitty things, for this audience, I thought I'd just take through the major pieces and then spend a little bit of time talking about how that impacts Texas. So, of course, as many of you have seen, it's been splashed across the headlines. The biggest sort of takeaway from the CBO score that we got last week was that the bill will result in an estimated 24 million more people being uninsured over the course of the next decade. To give you a sense of what that would mean, that would actually set us back from where worse and worse shape than we were before the ACA. Estimates at this point say the ACA basically helped insure 20 million people, so this would put us back to pre-ACA time. So that's, you know, of course, the big impact, sort of human impact. And then to sort of try to put this in buckets, let's talk a little bit about the individual market. That's what I think sort of takes the headlines most of the time and where most of the discussion is on. So in the individual market, there are major drastic changes to how the tax credits that are available under would make changes to that. Primarily, the idea would be today tax credits are based on your income, but they're also based on your geography where you're located. Under the new plan, these would be much smaller tax credits, and the only thing that they would adjust for is age. And even that adjustment, because of the fact that they're much smaller tax credits, would not cover the cost of care. So that change to the tax credits, and we can talk in more detail about that, but the change to the tax credits, what does it do? It actually, what it does is it sort of depends on where you're at in life and where your income is as to how it would affect you. There's actually a neat little tool that Vox put together with the help of the Urban Institute. So if you're curious on how a person like yourself would be impacted, if you were purchasing in the individual market, you could put your basic information, your age and your income are the two things that would impact that. And location, of course, impacts as well. So as a younger person at a higher income bracket, I would actually be benefited under the new plan, but that's not the point. The point is that their lower income, older people are very, very, very hurt, and because this law favors, the way that we've been putting it favors the healthy and the wealthy. That is by restructuring the tax credits this way. So the group hit the hardest are individuals between the ages of 50 and 64, so your pre Medicare recipients. And I will say that if you looked at the sign-up numbers, the take-up rate under the ACA, this was the group that came into the market under the ACA the quickest, because they're, of course, in a group that is more likely to be uninsured because they're not yet to Medicare age and in need of care and therefore motivated to get insurance. Well, these individuals could see just skyrocketing premiums to the point where you're talking a third to a half of their income would have to be spent just to afford it, which would mean they would simply go without care. And again, I don't want to spend too much time on any one piece because I know that you could just turn on NPR and hear a lot of these things. So I want to sort of go through all the pieces and then maybe get to Q&A so I can see where people want to dive in. But I think one really important piece that's not always as easy to explain because it really just differs based on where you live is the fact that the old tax credits used to be based on the cost of healthcare in your given area. And so the new tax credits don't adjust to that cost. And so the problem with that is that often rural areas are going to be hit really hard with this because those tax credits simply don't make up for the fact that if you're in a rural area, your health coverage is going to cost that much more. So just to keep the hits on coming, so we talked about how it doesn't adjust for income any longer. So if I make $15,000 a year or if I make $75,000 a year, I get the same tax credit. We've talked about how the fact that it's particularly hard on old people, but one of the reasons that that is true is because while the premium has gotten smaller, the ability for health plans to charge older people more has actually increased. So under today's plan, you can charge older people up to three times as much as a younger person. Under the new bill, you could charge five times as much. So that's where you end up with those skyrocketing premiums. So smaller tax credits that don't adjust for age, don't adjust for income, don't adjust for location, the ability to charge older people a substantial amount more. And then if that wasn't enough, the cost-sharing reductions that reduce your out-of-pocket costs. So these are things that help keep deductibles down, things that help keep a nice copay structure in a plan so that you can go see the doctor and maybe only have to pay a copay before you ever even hit your deductible. All of those were paid for by cost-sharing subsidies. The new plan doesn't include those at all. Those are eliminated altogether. And then, And then finally, so we've got this increase in premium due to the lack of tax credits. And then you have this increase in out-of-pocket costs because the cost-sharing reduction goes down. But just to, like, top it all off, the final sort of blow is that while the bill does keep the requirement to cover all of the essential health benefits, so you still have to cover those 10 benefits that were listed out in the ACA. The reason the bill keeps it is because you couldn't repeal that through a reconciliation process. And we could talk more about that if there are people on the call who don't know what I mean by that. But they keep the essential health benefits, but they get rid of all of the other pieces that require a certain level of coverage. So if you remember in the marketplace, there was bronze coverage that covered at 60%, silver at 70%, and gold at 80+. And then those cost-sharing reductions would increase those, so you'd get even better deal if you were under 250% of the federal poverty level. Well, it gets rid of that tiering structure altogether. It does keep the essential health benefits. So you may notice if you've read pieces on the CBO score, what the CBO has assumed is that basically means that you're going to go to what's called an actuarial value. Don't get caught up in that term. But basically, we're going to go to 65% coverage. So the plans will likely only cover about 65% of your costs. Whereas before, people who were getting a nice tax credit with the cost-sharing reduction, they could have gotten up to 80% of their costs covered. So you really got an increase to out-of-pocket costs as well. Just a few other things on the individual market, but I guess a little more generally. It does get rid of the individual mandate. We expected this to come in And what it replaces it with is this idea, this concept of continuous coverage. And again, this was something that we knew was coming. And what would happen is if you have any sort of a lapse in your coverage, so if you drop coverage for some reason and then you try to come back in, they could put a 30% premium increase for those individuals whose coverage lapsed. So on top of all of the other pieces, you could have this surcharge in your premium as well. And losing that individual mandate might also be very impactful to younger, to the motivation of younger people to come into the market. So we may also just see rises in premiums simply because fewer healthier people are in the market because they have no stick to sort of force them in there. They may have some carrots in that their coverage may be less expensive based on the new tax credits, but it doesn't, there's no stick. So that sort of covers the individual market section of the repeal plan. But I will tell you the nastiest part of this bill, though just the part that really keeps me up at night, is what the intention to cut $880 billion from the Medicaid program by 2026. So that represents about a 25% cut in what the government currently spends in their Medicaid budget. And I want to just emphasize here that this is being sort of touted as we're reducing the federal deficit, this is cost savings. It should be made very clear that cost shifting is not cost savings. This will simply shift those costs to the state, and then the state is left with the decisions on what to do to make up for those costs. Given the history of the Texas legislature, there is not a lot of anticipation by people like myself that the Texas legislature is going to come in and pick up the tab where these cuts fall short. And so what we expect is that basically the Texas legislature then shifts that down to local governments and to beneficiaries. So likely this would result in cutting benefits to Medicaid recipients or cutting enrollment to Medicaid recipients. In fact, the CBO report itself points this out because it would leave states to decide whether to commit more of their own resources to the program or whether to reduce spending by cutting payments to healthcare providers, health plans, eliminating optional services, restricting eligibility for enrollment, or to the extent feasible, arriving at more efficient methods for delivery services. I can tell you that Medicaid is already one of the most efficient insurance programs in the country. It's much more cost effective than private insurance. So cuts to beneficiaries and enrollment, cuts to payments to providers, which are already at just a crazy low level in Texas, that's what we would be looking at in the Medicaid program. And I know there's a lot of talk about the Medicaid expansion, which we didn't do, and it's an important piece. So the new amendment to the manager amendment to the bill actually keeps states from being able to take the Medicaid expansion in the future, which would lock Texas into our decision that we have not expanded, and so that would be a very large problem. We would continue to have our 800,000 plus uninsured population in the Medicaid gap, but on top of that, the children, people with disabilities, pregnant women, and low-income parents and seniors who currently are beneficiaries of our Medicaid program could be vastly hurt depending on the decisions that our state would make to on how exactly they would make up for that huge cut in funding coming to our state. And finally, just to sort of emphasize where are those cost shiftings going, we mentioned the beneficiaries, but also the local government. When this bill, as we talked about, 24 million more uninsured. So in Texas, that means a huge increase in our uninsured population, which means more uncompensated care costs coming out of your local hospital district dollars. I'm sorry that I don't know off the top of my head, but I do know that when we looked at Harris County here in Houston, if you look at the cost of uncompensated care for a hospital district on a yearly basis and you compare it to what we pay in property taxes, everybody complains about property taxes in Texas, right? Well, if you look at those two numbers, they're roughly equivalent. So that is the sheer enormous, you know, just the sheer impact of uncompensated care costs on your local healthcare dollars. That is just going to get worse if we go backwards from where we've been to a pre-ACA or worse than pre-ACA number of uninsured. I want to make sure that I didn't miss anything. I think that the sort of just final point to drive home, we talked about the sort of human impact, the number of uninsured, the financial impact of shifting costs, both in the individual market and the Medicaid, but who are the people who benefit? You know, whenever you look at a policy, you should always ask who benefits. Well, included in this bill is a $600 billion in tax breaks that are primarily focused on your very wealthy and insurance CEOs. And I think that that makes the talking point in itself. We're cutting a program that provides 45% of Texas kids their insurance, and what's the trade-off is tax cuts for the wealthiest individuals. So I am going to leave it at that and open it up to questions, however you want to handle that, Lisa.
Okay, so Noah, are you back on? He messaged me that he stepped away for a minute. he has control over the Q&A. But I'm going to ask you a couple of questions while we're waiting for him to come back. So a statistic that you said just there at the very end is that these cuts impact 45% of Texas kids. So 45% of Texas kids currently get their insurance through Medicaid. Is that what I'm hearing?
That does include the CHIP program as well. But, yes, the CHIP program is a tenth the size of the Medicaid program. So, yes, 3 million Texas children, so plus about 300,000 in the CHIP program. That's 45% of our kids in Texas get their insurance through Medicaid or CHIP. And those are the kids who actually are on it. But half of the births in Medicaid, so if you're talking about newborns, half of our births are covered by the Medicaid program. So to get the full impact, you would sort of look at both of those pieces. So, yes, a huge number of our children, you know, benefit from this program, and the benefits that come from being enrolled in this program. I mean, there are very strong correlations between high school completion, future income earnings. This program has been shown through good evidence to be a real foundation for low-income kids from which they can build to be more successful in life. And so when you're cutting 25% of those funds, where is that going to come out of? How is that going to impact these populations? And what does that mean for the next generation of Texans? It's a real concern. There's a great, for those who like to read really well-written articles, there's a great article in The Atlantic that was published yesterday that speaks about sort of the silent victims of this bill, which are children who don't get a vote. And so we really have to be the voice for them.
So still staying on the Medicaid topic, one of the things, or I guess two things that we saw get added to this legislation over the last couple of days with respect to Medicaid is the option for states to accept a block grant, if I understand that correctly, or Medicaid will simply be turned into a block grant, and that states can consider adding work requirements. So what do those two things look like for Texas's program?
Great. That's a good question. Great question. I will say per capita caps are almost as bad as block grants. The only thing that a block grant improves on is that it allows for adjustment for enrollment. It's unclear exactly what Texas would do. I will tell you that we do have a law in place that would basically direct our Medicaid agency to take up a block grant option if it were available. But we do have some indication from some things that Abbott has said over the last few months that he recognizes that that per capita caps would be a better option, so it could, because it can adjust for enrollment. So I definitely think these provisions, just to sort of get the high level, these were called sweeteners. You may have seen that used in the news today. And these were ways to get more conservative House members in favor of the bill. So these are definitely more conservative approaches. So I do think that there's a possibility we could take the block grant option if it were put on the table, there is some indication from our governor that he may be aware of the difference that a per capita cap could make. Oh my goodness, I lost my train of thought. The second piece. Work requirements. Thank you. I absolutely think that Texas would look into work requirements. Even if this doesn't get put into this bill, there was some sort of like light sub-guidance given by Verma this week as soon as she was appointed, that basically sort of like did all but endorse work requirements in the Medicaid program. So if we were to see that in this actual bill and this bill get passed, Texas, I have no doubt in my mind that Texas would take that up. We have long been a state that looked to make one of the most, all of the most conservative decisions we could in our Medicaid program. We have the lowest income limits in the U.S. for our low-income parents, as an example. We do periodic income checks, checking against income sources for our kids. We are consistently taking the most conservative options available on the table. So I do believe that if that were made available under this bill or through administrative action, we would take that option. This is very problematic, an example of not just the fact that this is a health insurance program and shouldn't be tied to work requirements, which was the stance of our previous administration anytime work requirements were requested in a waiver. But not only is it just fundamentally sort of flawed in logic, but there's some real concerns. Under the way that it's written, you basically, the only way to get an exemption, there are a few people who would be exempted from this.
The host has joined the conference.
An example of this is a person with disabilities, but in order to be defined as a person with disabilities, you have to be eligible for SSI. There are people with debilitating healthcare needs that are not under the SSI definition considered disabled, and yet under these work requirements, they would be considered quote unquote able-bodied and therefore required to go to work. There's, of course, huge implications with anyone with a mental health illness. The idea that you would need to be able to work and stay at work in order to get your health care, in order to get your treatment, that can put the cart before the horse. So these are some of the populations that could be very impacted by this, and we've seen in other social service programs where work requirements have been very detrimental. I want to also point out one last piece that's a piece of this that wasn't necessarily out in the amendment, but it was in the original bill, and it's a lesser known piece. It gets rid of what's known as 3 months prior coverage. So if I'm a person and I'm very sick, this is often very beneficial to hospitals, but I'm very sick, I come to the hospital, I get emergency care, and they recognize that I am simply an uninsured person who should have been enrolled in Medicaid, then they can go ahead and enroll me, and it allows them to get anything that I've gotten done up to that point covered for in Medicaid. So it actually goes 3 months backwards to sort of look for any healthcare costs that the individual had. Well, this can be very helpful to the individual that those healthcare costs don't come down on them. It's helpful to the hospitals. And we also see this being useful when there are glitches in our eligibility system. Would that mean, meaning that it takes a long time for you to be found eligible for Medicaid, even though you were eligible all along? Well, it's getting rid of that. That's been a piece of this program for years, and it's just, I didn't see it coming. Maybe some of my more informed colleagues in Washington would have seen that, but that would be another real hit to just how our healthcare system works and to the, again, to the sort of financial stability of low-income Texans that rely on this program for their insurance, especially for children.
Okay. So thank you very much for all of that. Noah, are you there? We're having some technical difficulties.
Yes, so the power went off at my house, and I'm on a computer with a dashboard where I was trying to go off on two different phones to unmute both lines. I'm going to try something, which is just a keyboard shortcut that might work, and it will unmute everyone at once if it works. And so just mute yourself if you're not the one speaking. Just hold on 1 second.
Please hold. Sorry about this, y'all.
Okay. So everybody, we can hear everyone. You are not speaking. Mute your own line. And we can go ahead and open it up. It's going to be, there's about 30 people on, and so just be patient. And we can go ahead and open it up for questions and just sort of jump on in. But if someone starts talking, then let them talk. So any questions? I guess we answered everything.
I have a question.
Great.
Well, this is Gary.
Go ahead.
And my parents live in a rural area, and the closest hospital is about 30 or 40 miles away, and it's going to go out of existence. They live in Colorado. I was wondering if the same thing's going to happen here in Texas.
Do you mean closures of rural hospitals?
Yes.
Yeah, sure. So we're already seeing, we've already seen quite a few closures of rural hospitals here in Texas. We actually have, I mean, we're one of the biggest states, so we often top the charts at number of things going on. But we are one of the states with the highest number of rural hospital closures. I was actually just looking this up today. According to Torch, the Texas Association of Rural Hospitals, we've seen 15 hospitals closed since 2013, and there are a lot of different factors that go into that. Our high uninsured rate, having the highest uninsured rate in the country, definitely impacts those rural hospitals, and an increase to this uninsured rate coupled with a decrease in federal funding flowing to our hospitals through the Medicaid program would be a huge blow to our hospital system. So, yes, I definitely think that you would see the number of rural hospitals continue to increase, the number of closings of rural hospitals continue to increase. Like I said, they were already struggling. So this is just going to make it worse.
Okay, thank you.
I have a question.
Go ahead.
What is the rationale of the Republicans in making these cuts to Medicaid? What do they think will happen to all of these folks who need this kind of care?
I can answer the first question. The second question is also a mystery to me as well. So to answer the first question, what's their rationale? This goes along those lines of reducing their sort of high talking point that they're always talking about, which is reducing the federal deficit and ending entitlement programs. If you hear Paul Ryan talk about this, it's really hard for me to even listen to him talk to, because he gets giddy. A quote this week was he was talking about how I've been dreaming about this since we were drinking out of kegs, which just infuriated me. And I hope it infuriates some people on the call enough to call your representative, because it's just the most outrageous thing to say, because we're talking about cutting a program serving children and pregnant women and people with disabilities. And so, but that's the rationale, is this idea of reducing the federal deficit. And if you look at the CBO score, that's exactly what this bill does. But the primary driver of that is reducing the amount of tax credits available in the marketplace, but $880 billion in cuts to the Medicaid program. And if you have someone sort of pushing back on you, if you're maybe making a call to your representative saying, no, this is going to reduce this, we're just, you know, the Medicaid program spending is out of control. First off, it's not. Medicaid is as I mentioned before, it's actually more efficient than private insurance. The per beneficiary cost is lower than private insurance, so it's better and more efficient than private insurance. So it's not a bloated, broken system. And this is not just curbing costs. If you hear my boss talk about it, Ann Dunkelberg, she's been doing this work for a long time. This is not trimming the fat. This is cutting off a limb. A quarter of the funding would be cut away. But that is exactly what they want to do. Paul Ryan talks about our biggest drivers in spending in our federal deficit are Obamacare, Medicaid, and Medicare. And I think if he could privatize Medicare, he would, if it wouldn't lose him votes from that population. So that is his rationale behind it. This has been something he's been wanting to do for a really long time, and he openly admits it. Unfortunately, that means a lot of human suffering, of course, but it also, again, it's, I think, one important piece to push back on people who want to say this, use the fiscal argument against this, is that it's not actually saving costs, it's shifting the cost to states. Those people are still going to need to seek health care, and if they go uninsured, it's going to be more expensive health care that they seek from their emergency room that then the taxpayer has to pay for. And I would much rather pay for preventive care for children up front than for emergency room care if they're going uninsured. So the fiscal argument doesn't hold water either.
Yes, thank you for saying all that. I thought I must have been missing something, but apparently not. Their logic is not holding up. When you say that the Medicaid program is actually an efficient program, that it's not bloated, what can I point to when I'm calling my U.S. rep's office? Is there some study, or
absolutely,
is that a CBO finding?
There are numerous studies that show that both Medicaid and Medicare have a lower cost per beneficiary, and absent any changes to the programs, will continue to have a lower cost per beneficiary than private insurance. And so I'm happy to share those with Lisa so that she can share those with the group. It's actually a fairly well-established piece of information.
Okay, thank you.
And I want to emphasize, I should have mentioned this as well. We actually expected the Medicaid fight to happen later in the year. We weren't expecting it to come with a repeal bill for the ACA. But one of the rules is they can't do a reconciliation bill if it adds to the deficit. And so they wanted to cut all of these taxes that were imposed on the wealthiest families in order to pay for the Affordable Care Act. They wanted to make cuts to those taxes, which again cost about $600 billion. So they did the Medicaid piece of their agenda much earlier, because that's what they needed to make up that cost in this reconciliation bill to make sure that it reduced the federal deficit rather than increase it. So So another one of their rationales is, you know, they want to cut taxes to the wealthy, and the only way to do that in this process under the reconciliation rules was to include huge cuts to the Medicaid program.
So we have a page of resources that we created on the website this week. If you look on the right-hand side of the page, scroll down a little bit, you'll see our most recent blog posts, and one of them is called Week of Action on ACA Repeal. So when Melissa sends me the links for those studies, I will add them to that page, so you'll be able to find them there.
I have a question. Did I hear you correctly? Did you say that the uncompensated care costs in Harris County were equal to the property taxes?
To the revenue that's received through property taxes and what's paid into the hospital districts, they're roughly equal. And the reason we use that talking point prior to this entire debate, prior to November 8th, was, you know, we were trying to convince, trying to show individuals when you're talking about sort of that the impact that you're seeing from your local property taxes, you need to understand where that money's going, and you need to understand where relief is available. And one of the, and so we were pointing to the Medicaid expansion dollars that you can curb those uncompensated care costs significantly if you were to expand Medicaid and cover more people. And that remains our position, that more people covered is better because it curbs those uncompensated care costs. And yes, you're still going to pay for that somewhere. We're not ignoring the fact that these programs cost taxpayer dollars, but it's a much more efficient use of taxpayer dollars because you're paying for individuals to access their care through their primary care physician as opposed to going to the emergency room, which is often what happens when you're considering an individual who's uninsured. So, so yes, those, and I'm happy to get those numbers, but I also might see if we've pulled anything for Austin. I don't have that recollection that we did that recently, but I can definitely see, sort of give you the rough numbers. What are we talking about uncompensated care in the Austin area versus what are your property tax revenues in the Austin area?
How did you go about finding the uncompensated care costs?
That's actually, and that may be why we had it for Harris County. That's actually a great question. You're leading me right to my answers that I couldn't think of. We actually worked with the county commissioner's office. We have a great relationship with the former commissioner and the new commissioner here in Harris County. So I believe the uncompensated care costs were made available by through the county commissioner's office. So I think that's why we had it for Harris County, but I can definitely check on that to see what we might have for other localities that have a hospital district.
Okay, thank you.
I have a question.
Go ahead.
Go ahead.
Thanks. Just a quick one. I'm still, like, not very clear on I know what they said that with the new law, you can't be denied insurance if you have pre-existing conditions. But I wasn't really clear on, if you have a pre-existing condition, do you need to pay? Can they charge you more because you have it under the new law?
They can't. They couldn't repeal those provisions. Again, anything that they were able to repeal had to have a direct impact on the budget. So a lot of those pieces actually weren't repealable using the reconciliation process. But what will happen, what they can do is if you actually have any lapse in coverage, when you come back into the market, they can do a 30% surcharge for that lapse in coverage. Individuals with high healthcare needs may experience more lapse in coverage simply because they're busy dealing with their disease. And so you may see that, but that actually applies to everyone. Anyone who comes in and that's had a lapse in coverage will see a 30% surcharge But then for all of the other reasons that I mentioned before, for example, the fact that cost sharing, there's no longer going to be a cost sharing reduction available, so you'll see higher out-of-pocket costs and higher premiums. Individuals with high healthcare needs who need to seek care all the time, those higher out-of-pocket costs are really going to impact them more than maybe your young, healthy person who will just, you know, just maybe need to do their annual checkup. So you'll still see higher out-of-pocket costs, but you do not have the ability to deny someone coverage or charge them more solely because they have a pre-existing condition. But charge older individuals significantly more. So the age is still there.
I see. And so that's where the discrimination is coming in. And then also, what about the lifetime maximums? Are they reinstating caps on that, like before the ACA, or is that untouched as well from the ACA?
That is untouched as well. So we'll still see you'll still see annual. Not only will there not be this ability to sort of cap someone at a lifetime or an annual limit the way that we would see before the ACA, but it keeps the ACA's out-of-pocket maxes. Now, again, you're still going to see huge out-of-pocket costs for individuals, and premiums do not get included. Anything you pay out-of-pocket for a premium would not be included as something that would be count towards your out-of-pocket max. So you're still going to see individuals older. If you're lower income and a person between 50 and 64, the likelihood that you could afford the insurance that would be made available to you on the marketplaces is very low. And that's actually by design. The idea would be that you'd have your older individuals go uninsured, and you'd have younger individuals who would maybe be more likely to pick up coverage because you could see cheaper plans just because they're skinnier plans that are available to those younger individuals. And it shifts, again, all of the tax credits, to sort of sum it up, they benefit the healthy and the wealthy. So if you're a younger person, you may see some benefit under this plan, or if you're a wealthier person who would have been ineligible for tax credits under the ACA, and you will see some slight benefit. But again, those credits are so small under the new plan, they really wouldn't cover much, but it is more than they were getting before, which was nothing.
Melissa, I want to ask you a follow-up to that, because as you have noted a couple of times, there are things that could not be done with this bill because it is being done through the reconciliation process. But some of these things that we're talking about, pre-existing conditions, lifetime and annual caps, are those potentially on the table when they move to the stage where they're looking at the regulations and the rules?
I think that's a great question. They will still all be in law, think one piece but I'm glad that you brought up rules and regulations, because while this whole debate's been going on, and I have a blog post that you're welcome to share with anybody, while this whole debate's been going on, five days after Tom Price was confirmed for Secretary of HHS, proposed rules on changes to the marketplace were actually released by CMS that did some harmful things to the marketplace through regulation that have gotten a lot less attention because just, you know, a few weeks later we had the same week we had the outline from the Republicans, and then the next week we saw their bill, and so then it just really came down to the bill, which, of course, deserves the most attention. But I think what people need to keep in mind, because, you know, we're going to have some sort of resolution on the legislative piece of this over the next few weeks. But keep in mind that the administrative branch, as Lisa has pointed out, still has a considerable amount of power to interpret the law and make adjustments that could be harmful for consumers, and that is exactly what those proposed rules did. They were basically the health plan's wish list made into rules. And there are some pieces, and they ask about things like continuous coverage requirements, which is something we've seen in this bill, this idea of if you drop out of coverage, then we can charge you a surcharge when you get back in. But it was sort of, I was taken aback along with many other health policy wonks that it was put into regulation, because if anything were to ever pass through regulation that tried to touch that with the ACA's law still in place, the assumption would be that it would be contrary to the law and that you may see it go to the judicial, through a judicial process to, you know, you would see people sue immediately, basically. So so it's still an important process, and the administration can make some changes that can be harmful to consumers, but they are technically limited by the law, but what it, what their interpretation of the law is may be questionable.
Okay. So I think we have time for one more question, if there's a hot and burning one out there. Okay. Well, hearing none, I think we will wrap up here. As I mentioned before, as Melissa sends us some additional resources, we will add them to our Week of Action resource page. This vote is happening on Thursday. It's unclear what time, but please plan to continue calling your members of Congress through Thursday. We really hope that tonight's call and the resources we've provided are helping you with your advocacy on this issue. We would love to hear feedback if they are, and also if they're not, if we overwhelmed you with information. that's always good to know, too. So, Melissa, thank you again for joining us tonight. And thanks, everyone, for joining us on the call. We will post information about our topic for next week as soon as we have it settled. So thanks again.
Thank you, Lisa. Right. Thanks, everyone, for doing what you're doing.
Thank you so much to everyone and to everyone who stayed on the line, which I think was just about everybody through our technical difficulties. And just so you know, I believe the recording will still work, and so we can listen to those technical difficulties whenever we like at a future date. It will be posted on the website tomorrow. So thank you, everyone. We'll be back same time next week with another great speaker and another great topic. Stay tuned. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Take care.
Bye-bye.